It's The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for joining us today. It's great to have you with us. Protests continued in Iran overnight and into today and have spread to dozens of cities. Government security forces have killed at least 21 people so far, but numbers are hard to verify because of censorship within Iran. At least 500 people have been arrested in Tehran alone. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, was on Twitter on Tuesday giving his first public reaction to the anti-government demonstrations. The Ayatollah says enemies of Iran have allied to use the various means they possess, including money, weapons, politics, and intelligence services, to trouble the Islamic Republic. Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, and he's been following the unrest, and he brings us the latest.
The Iranian government has organized nationwide counter-protests in several cities, of course, meant as a show of strength. The English language state channel here, Press TV, said that the pro-government protests were in reaction to all the violence, as they called it, that had taken place during the week. And some of the protesters, the pro-government protesters again, also referred to that, saying that they were against the rioters. So far from the government side, but there have also been anti-government protests in several cities last night, which is hard to exactly verify because this only comes to me through videos and some phone calls. In the city of Shiraz, some people went on the streets and shouted slogans. In the city of Rush, the same thing happened. And in the small city of Khomeini Shahr, named after the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, people tried to burn down a seminary, a place where Shiite Muslims received their theological teachings. And this was also captured on video.
Meanwhile, Thomas, you've been learning more about what caused these protests, or at least caused them to grow in the first place. There was some confusion in the early hours, the early days, about who exactly was protesting and why, who might have been behind it. And you've been learning more.
Yes, well, what happened was that the initial protest, the one that sparked all the anti-government protests in the country, started on Thursday in the city of Mashhad. Now, Mashhad is a religious city. It's a city with lots of importance in Iran. It's where the eighth imam of the Shiites, Imam Reza, is buried. And suddenly, around noon, a group of people there, without making any announcement on the internet or social media, showed up there and started shouting slogans against President Rouhani and shouted slogans like "Death to the dictator." And that protest was actually filmed and distributed on Telegram, which is a messaging app that 48 million Iranians use. And after that, the other protests really took off. But what we've learned is that the protest in Mashhad was most likely organized by hardliners who wanted to try and make President Rouhani look bad, because also President Rouhani, just some weeks before, had presented his proposed budget, in which he had, for the first time, also revealed the details of how much money religious institutions are getting. Now, the same budget also called for a hike in fuel prices, for an end to subsidies to 30 million Iranians. It called for a higher departure tax for Iranians wanting to go abroad. So when people saw how much money these institutions were getting, or sometimes up to hundreds of millions of dollars or the equivalent of that, that had already fueled a lot of anger. And then when people saw that in Mashhad, protesters suddenly came out, they followed suit, and that led to a whole chain of events.
You've been writing also about internal power struggles within the Iranian government.
Yes, Iran is from a distance, and especially from the United States, often viewed as a full-on theocratic dictatorship. But there are actually different shades of gray in this country. And two factions that you might have heard of are the reformists and the conservatives, or hardliners, if you will. Now, both groups try to control Iran. They have a long-standing fight, and the reformist moderate faction currently is headed by President Rouhani, who is seeking greater power in order to make more change inside the country. And you can also see that he is now using the result of this week of protest as a reason why he should be getting more power and more ability to make changes, because he is pointing out that people should have the right to demonstrate. Of course, they should not vandalize things, and people should be able to express themselves more. So he is using the protests that were actually against him as a sort of leverage to force hardliners that control Iran's other centers of power, like the judiciary, to allow these changes to take place, to give more freedom to people and to allow for more changes in the economy.
Can you describe a little bit some of the clashes, at least as much as can be known, about what's gotten people killed in these cases?
I think it's really important to understand that people came out onto the streets because of all the economical pressures that are coming down upon them. There's high unemployment, there's high inflation. People feel that literally they have reached the end. The level of violence used by the security forces led to at least 21 people dead. So it is obvious that protesters felt prompted to engage with the security forces, and that also security forces felt the need to quell this protest. Now, I've heard of a story of a 15-year-old boy that was killed in that city I just mentioned before, Khomeini Shahr, where people tried to burn down a seminary. It is unclear what the exact circumstances were, how this boy died. But you can imagine that if such a thing happens, it will entice people to also use violence as they are protesting.
Thomas Erdbrink in Tehran with the New York Times. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Meanwhile, while these protests spread around Iran, countries in the region are watching closely, looking for signs of instability within Iran. Borzu Deragahi has a view now from Istanbul, where he reports for BuzzFeed. Borzu, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Borzu, you're there in Istanbul. Turkey has expressed concern publicly and concerns over violence during the protests in Iran. Does this go beyond sort of normal diplomatically framed concern that we see a lot in situations like this? What's Turkey worried about?
You know, the language is rather normal diplomatic language, but it's my understanding that the Turkish government does not want a revolution, another uprising in another neighboring country. They're worried about instability. They're worried about refugees and so on. If Iran should descend into the kind of situation that Iraq and Syria have descended into, and probably when push comes to shove, the Turkish government will side with the forces of stability, i.e. the regime, over the forces of what it perceives as instability, this sort of undefined mass of protesters.
We were just talking a couple of minutes ago about how the Ayatollah in Iran had blamed Iran's enemies for the protests. Usually that means the United States, and may in fact to the regime mean the United States this time. But what about Saudi Arabia and some of Iran's other rivals? I wonder how those countries are viewing these protests and how the regime inside Iran might be viewing their influence.
Well, you know, I mean, that's an easy way of getting national sentiment whipped up is, you know, referring to conspiracies by, you know, the Arabs, which in the case of Iran usually means Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the Saudi crown prince, unfortunately, earlier this year had said that, you know, we will not let the Iranians come and, you know, do battle here. He said something to the effect of, we're going to take the battle to Iran. And so that kind of plays into the hands of the regime, you know. And I have spoken to people who were, you know, on the front lines of the 2009 uprising, people in Iran and also in the diaspora who were in the 2009 uprising. And I asked them, why aren't you supporting this movement now? Why aren't you out there in the street? And one of the things they say is like, well, we don't know who is behind these protests. Is it a conspiracy by the hardliners? Is it Saudi Arabia? Is it, you know, the CIA? And Trump said he's going to try to destabilize Iran too. What if this is all a sort of conspiracy? What if there is this sort of hall of mirrors? We don't want to get duped into that hall of mirrors. And I think that's one of the issues that's going to be at play going forward is, you know, these guys have no leaders, these protesters. They have no organizational structure. They have no address. In 2009, you had the reform movement of Iran with its politicians, its parties, its civil society groups as the address for the protest movement, at least large swaths of it. This time around, we don't know, you know, who's behind these guys. My sense is that there's no one behind them. This is a viral sensation, people frustrated, people angry, the people who've been trampled upon for decades, ignored by the political leaders. These are the people who are rising up at this point. And I can understand their anger because I've heard it many times when I've been in Iran. But, you know, it's not certain who is behind it.
Do you see any similarities in the populist sentiment from lower middle class and low income people in Iran to what goes on in the West and what's gone on in the United States? I mean, I know they're completely different cultures. Is it a similar kind of frustration?
Yeah, there's a similar kind of frustration at Iran's version of neoliberalism, which is this kind of philosophy of trickle-down austerity, you know, austerity measures for the bulk of people meant to keep inflation low to encourage investment. And, you know, that is, you know, hurting a lot of people at this point. And there's also a similarity in the kind of rising nationalism among Iranians, you know, and that can be played either way, that nationalism. It can be played for kind of a populist left-wing cause, like, you know, we're being humiliated by the big fat cats and so on. Or it can be played in a sort of demagogic, xenophobic way, like, you know, we have to stand up to these, you know, American and Israeli and Saudi invaders, go out there and crush them. And that feeling is, you know, kind of rising up. People are becoming more chauvinistic throughout the world, you know, not less. And that emotion, that emotional connection to one's nation can be abused in, you know, rather terrible ways sometimes.
Borzu, in easing off of sanctions after the nuclear agreement with Iran was supposed to, at least from the outside, relieve some of these pressures, right? Give Iran access to hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue, frozen assets, oil revenue that they could sell on the world stage, and help them help their own people inside Iran. Is that happening?
It did happen. There were some economic growth pro-sanctions. You know, I live in Istanbul, so all of a sudden I've seen in the last couple of years just a fresh new flood of Iranian tourists coming here to Turkey and spending money that they didn't have before. What happened is that you had the sanctions relief. It did ease some of the pressure, especially in places like Tehran, where there are international businesses, where there's international investment and so on, where there's kind of a certain cachet of living there. Real estate prices went up, but it didn't lift all boats. And I think that created a lot of resentment, while at the same time, the easing of sanctions really raised expectations, maybe much higher than the regime is capable of fulfilling. And so that created a lot of problems and anger as well.
And so what about now, these messages of support from President Trump on Twitter? Does that support even reach the protesters, the people on the streets? And if they're hearing it, do they want to hear it from President Trump?
I think it does reach people. I think that there are some people who welcome it, some Iranians who welcome that. They say the world is not forgetting us and so on. But I think by and large, it's probably a little bit of a mistake, just a little bit. It's not a decisive mistake, because it gives the regime more rhetorical ammunition when, not if, when it decides to violently crack down and smear the protesters as foreign agents.
Borzu Deragahi in Istanbul for BuzzFeed. Borzu, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
One brother allegedly shot and killed another after a fight that started earlier at a New Year's Eve party elsewhere.
Looking for a suspect wanted for shooting three people, including a young girl in South Los Angeles.
Right now on Flint's north side, a child hit in a drive-by shooting.
Out of Colorado, the sheriff's deputy there has been killed and four other deputies have been wounded.
A 10-year-old boy is possibly the victim of this shooting. We are told that he possibly was shot in the head.
A 16-year-old accused of shooting his parents, his sister, and a family friend with an automatic rifle.
They heard about 5 to 10 gunshots.
Multiple bullet holes in a white Infiniti at the scene.
One man is dead after shots were fired in Lauder Hill.
Shot in a party inside the apartment complex.
And again, there's no word on who shot him or why.
2018 is already off to a violent start in America. At least 50 people were killed in over 130 gun-related incidents in just the first 24 hours of this new year. That's according to the Gun Violence Archive. They're an organization tracking gun violence in the United States. Alex Yablon is back with me now. He's a reporter at The Trace. He joins me to talk about gun-related incidents so far this year. Alex, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Alex, 50 killed so far in a 24-hour period to start the year sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but it's pretty much on pace for the usual number of gun deaths over the course of a year, right?
Yeah, actually, those figures have been updated since we first put out that post. It's now there are reports it's up to 61 killed just on January 1st and 98 injured, which is still, you know, right in the middle of the pack for this day in the past, you know, 5 years or so. Three of the last 5 years have seen 61 people killed on January 1st.
So as violent as this sounds, and it is violent, maybe the story here is just how very normal 61 people within the first 2 days of the year really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, it's winter, so it's we generally see lower levels of shootings when it's cold out. You know, people aren't out on the street as much. You know, the average for the whole year is typically something like 95 people per day, though that's counting a lot of suicides, which don't often make it into the news.
Well, Alex, you've been looking back on 2017 and looking for patterns in gun violence across the country. Any red flags that are raising concern as you look at where the shootings are happening and how?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of like struggling deindustrializing cities, and then places in the South. You know, the pattern is we have a lot of public institutions that we're putting a lot of pressure on to solve this problem, but they have fewer and fewer resources, you know, either due to declining tax bases or decisions to deliberately cut public spending.
So those are some of the demographic and economic pressures. What about right to carry laws? The number of states spreading that have right to carry laws and expanding gun ownership?
Yeah, that's something we've been really keeping track of. It's becoming you know, pretty normalized among the hardcore gun rights movement to press for as few barriers as possible, sometimes no barriers to carrying a gun in public. You know, just this past month, the governor of Arkansas decided, you know, in contradiction of his own state's judges, that a pre-existing law legalized the right to open carry. You know, a defendant in a civil case had argued that that was the same, had made the same argument, and the judge has said that's nonsensical. But now the governor endorses that view. So that kind of really aggressive pro-carry position is becoming the default for a lot of pro-gun activists and pro-gun politicians.
61 gun deaths across America in just the first 2 days of 2018, which is actually right in the center of the curve for gun violence in this country. Alex Yablon with The Trace. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Let's focus now on one of America's worst cities when it comes to gun violence. Police in Chicago now say their city saw an improvement in homicides in 2017. There were 650 homicides in Chicago in 2017 compared to 771 the year before. Still, violence is extremely high in Chicago, even as other major cities see record lows in their homicide rates. Sherry Runner is CEO of the Chicago Urban League. She joins me now. Sherry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Sherry, over 100 fewer homicides in your city in 2017 compared to the year before. The police department is claiming credit for the success. Would you call it a success?
I think the important thing for all of us to understand is that homicides, the numbers are real people. And so the fact that 100 less lives were taken through gun violence in the city of Chicago is obviously an improvement. And we need to make sure that we understand the ramifications of what every life means to every family in which this occurs. So statistics are one thing, but it's a much bigger issue.
Well, let's talk about the policing part of it for just a moment. The police department has set up these strategic decision support centers in order to respond faster to gunfire around the city. What are these centers, and have they worked well?
They have been set up in certain communities where the gun violence is the most prevalent, and they are computer-based systems which use what a technology called shot stoppers, which allows the police to know where the shots are being fired more quickly so that they can respond more quickly. And in those communities, the crime has been reduced. But I guess the question for me is policing really the answer to this problem? Is policing more of a reactive policy than a proactive policy to address the issues that create the situations where these shootings occur in the first place?
And that goes right to the question of whether the social conditions that lead to violence have changed at all over the last year or 5 years in Chicago. Better education, better housing, job training. Have you seen an appreciable improvement in any of these areas that could be connected to a reduction in violence?
We know that in Chicago, we've got some really deep-seated issues with our educational system, with our housing practices in terms of the segregation, Chicago being one of the most segregated cities in the United States. But that alone does not mean that neighborhoods will not thrive. That alone is not a cause. That is the investment in these communities and the change from a community being based in industry and job availability and a number of just resources that have to go into communities where people care about them. Those things have certainly deteriorated over time.
What's your best realistic hope for 2018, for this next year, when it comes to violence in Chicago?
We cannot continue to do the same things and expect different outcomes. We need to recognize something that's very important about Chicago. One thing is that we are known as, and always have been, a transportation hub. It's one of the reasons why we are one of the most important cities in the nation. And I think that we have to recognize that with that comes a tremendous amount of responsibility for where these guns are coming into the city of Chicago, and that needs to be addressed. It's not just our neighbors with lax gun laws, and it's not our restrictive gun laws, quote unquote. It is a matter of who's making money trafficking guns through Chicago. There was a study just done by Harvard University that talked about, not just in Chicago, but nationwide, the availability, the sheer availability of guns is one of the factors that causes the tremendous amount of shootings that we have. And Chicago is a target point for that kind of availability and trafficking. So that's one thing that we need to do. We also need to make sure that we really address the issues of education. That's a longer term issue, but we need to make sure that the kids that we're graduating from our high schools are ready with the skills that they're going to need to access the jobs.
Sherry Runner, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Sherry Runner is CEO of the Chicago Urban League. Welcome back. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we end the hour today in Germany, where a new law is cracking down hard on hate speech on social media. As of this week, sites like Facebook and Twitter have just 24 hours to take down posts containing hate speech deemed blatantly illegal by German law, and they have just 1 week to take action in less obvious cases. Now, one far-right member of parliament has already had her Twitter account suspended under the rules for anti-Muslim statements. How far could this crackdown go on speech in Germany, and who's responsible for policing what Germans say on their social media? David Kay is a law professor at UC Irvine and the UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Opinion and Expression. He joins me now. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
David, before we get deep into this, just remind us what the hate speech law is in Germany, and then we'll talk about how it's being applied to social media now.
Right. So under German law, it's essentially illegal, and this is consistent with international human rights law, to engage in the kind of hate speech that constitutes incitement to violence or hostility or discrimination. It's obviously very different from U.S. law because of its lower bar, and it's essentially its disconnection from another particular crime. So it's a relatively robust hate speech law in Germany.
Given, of course, Germany's history with World War II, the Holocaust, and massive violence fueled by hateful rhetoric for the years up to the war. Now let's talk about social media, because Germany has taken this robust law, as you say, against hate speech and told these big companies, Facebook, Twitter, and others, it's up to you to take down posts that might violate the law. How does it work?
That's right. So, I mean, I think it's important to identify a couple of the positive aspects of the German law first. You know, Germany, as is the case, I think, across Europe, has been feeling that they've lost quite a bit of control over their public space over the last several years, that it's been dominated by companies like Facebook and Google. And so they adopted this law, which was actually quite popular. that basically says that if a social media company allows what they call manifestly unlawful content on their platform and they're notified of it, within 24 hours they have to take it down, or they'll be subject to very substantial fines, up to 50 million euros or $60 million for each instance. The timing gets a little more extended if we're talking about more complicated issues of German law. But generally speaking, the idea is impose very high fines on the companies when they allow hate speech, Holocaust denial, other kinds of what we would call speech crimes to be shared on their platforms.
Well, a $60 million fine is no joke. There's certainly a meaningful disincentive there. Still, David, government of Germany appears to be outsourcing enforcement of its speech laws, right? Is this a new mode of a shared responsibility with these big corporations?
Yeah. So this is the interesting part in many ways, and really the problematic part. So while on the one hand, Germany and the European Union more generally have been pushing the companies to more tightly regulate, more closely regulate their platforms, which I think is a shared idea in the United States as well, they're also basically saying to the companies, you need to do this. You need to be assessing and evaluating, much as in normal speech laws, the courts do, you need to be assessing what's happening on your platforms. And I think in general, there's a positive idea behind that, right? It's essentially the idea that German law should be applicable to social media companies when they're operating in Germany. The problem is that this very high cost, as you said, will be a strong incentive for the companies to regulate. And in order to avoid the fines, they're very likely to overregulate. They're likely to take down content that they might not otherwise take down because of the fear of these high fines. And so I think we're heading into a period where, because of this outsourcing and because the courts won't be involved, we'll see a lot more content taken down. And then we'll also see, because of the high cost, a concentration of and a dominance, continued dominance of companies like Facebook and Google, because it's going to be expensive for smaller companies to get into the market.
And then the questions, the reflexive questions that a lot of Americans are going to have in this situation, and rightfully so. There are a lot of fights here already in the United States, pressure on these social networks, Facebook and Twitter, to police the speech on their private networks, pressure all the time. You see it on Twitter for them to take down posts, suspend users because of Twitter's rules. The laws here are different. We have a First Amendment. But is there a lesson or a cautionary tale coming from Germany about what could or should happen in the United States?
I think there are two lessons here. On the one hand, it's very unlikely, because the First Amendment imposes such restrictions on government control of speech. It's very unlikely that we will see the same kind of laws in the United States. But I think we will continue to see the kind of pressure on the companies that we're seeing on across Europe. And that pressure, I think, is leading the companies to more closely regulate content on their platforms, which, you know, in some respects may be a positive, but at the same time, this pressure, even without the force of law, I think will lead the companies to regulate content in ways that might make some of us uncomfortable. I mean, we're already seeing takedowns of content in the United States and around the world on Twitter, on YouTube, on Facebook, that really are inconsistent with First Amendment freedoms or with human rights law as it pertains to freedom of expression. So, you know, what we're seeing in Europe, I think, is an example of what we're seeing, even if it doesn't have the force of law in other jurisdictions like the United States.
You know, we talk increasingly about the internet as a utility and what it means for it to be a mode of communication for all of society. And we may be entering a phase now where social media platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, find themselves to be speech utilities. What does that mean for their role in society and their role under the law? David Kaye, UC Irvine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
This is Lolly Watt from Wilmette, Illinois, and I'm calling to say that I definitely think big social media companies should have to pay hefty fines for leaving up hate speech because that would stop them allowing people, including the president, to spread hateful and intentionally misleading lies. It is really bad for the state of our nation.
The biggest problem I can see with outlawing hate speech is who would be the judge of what is or what is not hate speech. Just because you disagree with me, does that mean I can say you're spewing hate speech or vice versa?
My name is Damani. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I agree completely that you, the United States, should also do it. Our companies, especially huge conglomerates who have access to a mass audience, share messages that bring us closer together and nurture peace and understanding.
Lots of you would like to see companies face fines for hate speech on their platforms. And it's a law that, if we ever got there, certainly the Supreme Court would take a First Amendment interest in. Give us a call with your view, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We turn now to some possible thawing around the edges of the frozen relationship between North Korea and South Korea. News came yesterday that North Korea has reopened a border hotline with the South, and also negotiations are taking shape now, ostensibly to talk about bringing North Korean athletes to the Winter Games when they open in Pyeongchang, South Korea, next month. Is Olympic goodwill threatening to sweeten the relationship between North and South Korea here? Is anyone actually holding out for that? Curtis Melvin is here. He's a researcher at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Curtis, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Curtis, this border hotline we've been hearing about, how big a deal is it that it's back up and running now? What does this signal?
Well, this is an interesting turn of events in inter-Korean relations because a relationship between North and South Korea has deteriorated fairly steadily between under the former conservative presidents Imunbak and Park Geun-hye. Park Geun-hye closed the Kaesong Industrial Zone in North Korea, which was a business park that the South Koreans had built in North Korea. And when they closed that business park, the last vestige of the Sunshine Policy, North Korea shut off this communication line. And it's been off since then, and there's been no meaningful contact between the two governments. Now, this is interesting because there's been a venue provided for North Korea to reach out and reciprocate to the new president. You know, South Korea's new president has reached out to North Korea on numerous occasions, and the North Koreans have rebuffed him as they've continued to ramp up their nuclear and ballistic missile programs.
So the North reopens the closed hotline. Meanwhile, Kim says, let's sit down and talk because I think there are only two North Korean athletes who've qualified for the Olympic Games, two figure skaters, is that right, headed to the South for the Games. Let's sit down and talk about making the Olympic experience one of outreach here.
Yes. Many people who keep up with inter-Korean relations welcome the development because things like this lower tensions on the peninsula. They make the probability of miscalculations in the event of an unfortunate military or kinetic activity possible. And they open up the doors for negotiators on both sides to at least try to find avenues where we can resolve some longstanding problems. From the U.S. perspective, we've had multiple attempts to reach out and speak to North Korea, and we've even tried to speak with them without any preconditions, and the North Koreans have not been interested. And so it's a good timing. You know, the Olympics are very symbolic, but we still need to see exactly what North Korea wants to get out of this.
And that's a key question. Let's stick with the Olympics for 1 second and what the North wants. Talks over sending North Korean athletes to the Games in South Korea. Really about the Olympics or hopefully pretext for some more important issues?
Well, we can hope it's pretext and something substantive will come out of this. If I want to be a pessimist or realist, I could say that nothing, you know, North Korea participation in the Olympics might not be any more significant than their participation in other sporting events with South Korea. The North Koreans have sent teams to South Korea to compete before, and they've allowed South Koreans into North Korea to compete before. So we shouldn't get our hopes up too high. But the climate is better now. Kim Jong-un has made a public statement in front of his entire country and ours supporting participation in the Olympics. And, you know, if I can just harken back to the bad old days, you know, when Seoul last hosted the Olympics in 1988, the North Koreans blew up a South Korean airline, killing hundreds of people in the run-up to those games. So it's a positive turn that we want to see the North Koreans participating and that they wish South Korea well in these games.
Meanwhile, the bigger picture, Curtis, in the same set of statements where Kim Jong-un warmed things up with the South a little bit around the Olympics, around this hotline that we've talked about, assured the world and the United States that he has a nuclear button on his desk that he's willing to use. Our own president responded, assuring the world that his nuclear button is even bigger. That was the response from our president. Some analysts, and I don't know if you're included in this, have noticed that Kim may be hoping to warm things up with the South and drive a wedge between the longstanding allied relationship between South Korea and the United States.
Yes, this is a concern of many people in the foreign policy community. I haven't made my mind up yet as to what the North Koreans want because I haven't seen any solid information. And the Ministry of Unification in South Korea, which is handling the discussions, has not made public many of the comments that the North Koreans have made, except to say that they're discussing just the Olympics. It's possible that the North might be trying to get some concessions from the South, such as they want some kind of special standing, you know. They might want to have the games sort of be more about them. They might try to seek a delay in joint military drills between the U.S. and South Korea. So the devil is going to be in the details, and we should pay attention to those details. But right now, there's some cause for optimism because, you know, before the former South Korean president Park Geun-hye was impeached, the probability of North Korea attending the games was zero. And under the new president, this will be considered a win for his policy of reaching out to the North, and something may come of it. So we can always be cynical, but look hopefully into the future.
A little bit of stepwise de-escalation on the Korean Peninsula as talks around the Olympics at least open up between the North and the South, and everybody's now watching to see what the strategy from the North is when it comes to the relationship with the United States. Curtis Melvin with the U.S. Korea Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Congressional leaders are meeting today with White House officials to talk about a possible deal that could give lasting legal status to people currently benefiting from DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Democrats and more than a few Republicans say they want a DACA fix, but the question now is, what's the price? The president wants money for that border wall with Mexico. He's repeatedly said that any DACA legislation has to be tied to money for that wall. And in recent months, he's also ratcheted up the rhetoric over what he and many people on the right now call chain migration.
Ending chain migration and also ending the visa lottery will allow us to have common sense immigration rules that promote assimilation and wage growth. It also promotes, most importantly, safety. It'll help Americans, both old and new, to thrive, flourish, and prosper.
This is a strategy for a possible deal with Democrats in Congress whose votes may be needed to keep the government open if that's tied to immigration. Dara Lind explains also what this term chain migration that the president is talking about really means.
The way that it gets used, it's kind of just a synonym for family-based immigration, which is the way that a little over half of people who come to settle in the U.S. come is because they have a relative who's a U.S. citizen or in some cases a green card holder, and their relative says, okay, I'd like to bring my family member over to the U.S. The thing is that a lot of kinds of family-based immigration don't really create chains in the way you think of them, where like one person can bring another person can bring another person. The most common types are just bringing over your spouse, which like you can only bring one spouse over, or bringing over your kids who don't then have other relatives they can bring because they're kids. The more chain-like types of migration are like bringing over adult children, bringing over siblings, other people who might have families that they can bring. And those are pretty limited. They're the lowest priority for immigration. And the backlogs in terms of bringing over someone who's like a sibling of a citizen who was born in Mexico, we're talking something like a decade to 13 years. So it's a term that policy-wise refers to kind of the small slice of family-based immigration, but politically has come to mean the whole thing.
Well, the president's been talking a lot about chain migration. Let's listen to some of his comments from back in the middle of December, Dara. And I want to get your reaction to the way the president frames what he calls chain migration.
A single immigrant can begin a chain that could ultimately bring in dozens of increasingly distant relations. Because these individuals are admitted solely on the basis of family ties, not skill or not merit, most of this immigration is lower skilled, putting great strain on federal welfare.
Dara, the president paints a picture here of one migrant coming to the United States, sort of gaining a foothold and then opening the door to cousins, relatives, stepsisters, pretty much anyone in the family who wants to come. Is that an accurate picture that he's drawing?
The president is kind of taking the most extreme hypothetical scenario, something that, by the way, would take pretty much decades, and you ultimately have a bunch of people coming over in their 60s, and treating it as if that's the most common form of family-based immigration, which is not the case. Most people over the course of their lifetimes who come to the U.S. end up bringing over, you know, a couple of relatives, maybe just their, you know, spouse and children. Maybe they'll bring over their parents. It is theoretically possible under the law for something to happen like what the president is describing in terms of, you know, maybe you ultimately bring over your sister whose husband can then petition for his parents, who can then petition for their children. But the other side of what the president's describing is this kind of rubber stamp process where if as long as you want someone to come, they can come, which bears no relationship whatsoever to the way that people are actually vetted to come into the U.S. There is security vetting. There is kind of an assessment that if you're going to be a public charge, if you're going to use welfare, you won't be allowed to come into the U.S. So unsurprisingly for this president, he is taking something that, while not technically false, does misrepresent the way that people are actually vetted to come in.
Well, Dara, how did this one aspect of immigration policy become such a focus of the right and in the conservative news media, places like Fox News?
For a generation, Republicans rhetorically said, we love legal immigrants. We just don't like illegal ones, or we don't like unauthorized ones. A lot of conservatives, however, that wasn't really their problem with immigration. Their problem with immigration was they didn't want the cultural mix of America to change. They thought that America had a traditional culture and traditional values, and they didn't want people who didn't respect that culture and values to, you know, start dominating the American population. So anything that is going to change the, you know, demographic mix, anything where you're going to bring over a lot of children or you can't control the number of people who are coming in and make sure that every individual is being selected, is going to raise some red flags for them.
I mean, there have to be lots of examples about what immigration looks like if you only allow 25-year-old working-age males into the country. I think the construction of the railroads in the 1800s of this country had an immigration policy where only young men were allowed in, especially from Asia. Places like Dubai today have only young men coming in. What does immigration look like at those times and in those places when families don't come?
So what's interesting in what you're describing in both of the examples is that you're describing cases where low-skilled workers were needed just as a temporary labor force. We do have lots of examples of that. What we don't have any examples of are the kind of system that it seems like the Trump administration wants now, or at least the system that they're describing rhetorically, which is we only let in doctors. You know, we only let in individuals who have great educational qualifications who fill specific high-skilled needs in the economy. The weird thing about that is, for one thing, the countries that get named as examples of merit-based systems, Australia and Canada, have both had some problems with just selecting people based on merit. For one thing, they haven't had the history of being nations of immigrants that the U.S. has had, and so it hasn't been as much of a burden on their immigrant population to limit family-based immigration. But they've also, Canada in particular, had some issues with mismatches between the kinds of people who ideally they say they want and the needs they actually have in their economy, or the things that they can do to make sure immigrants actually do settle and integrate and put down roots in their communities. So it is wildly unclear what an ideal situation under the Trump administration's preferred immigration policy would look like.
Well, they're going to have to start to answer this question maybe in a substantive way over the next couple of weeks and months, because there is an immigration debate shaping up around recipients under the DACA program, 800,000 young people who came to this country. People are familiar with those DACA recipients now. Democrats and many Republicans say they want a way for those people to stay. The price, as the president and other Republicans have said, is money for a border wall and an end to this type of family migration, what the president calls chain migration. Is that the deal that's shaping up? What would that mean?
It is weirdly difficult at this point to say what the deal is that's shaping up, and maybe that's going to become clear in the next few days or weeks. But it has been very weird that Trump has paired money for a border wall, which is actually a really easy compromise to come to. It's not something that's going to be super hard for Democrats to give on. There will probably be some semantics on is it a fence or is it a wall, but you can easily see a world where Chuck Schumer says, yeah, we're giving him $1.5 billion, and in return, we're legalizing 700,000 people. But chain migration, or at least the way that Trump is expressing it, is he's asking for a cut in legal immigration to the U.S. going forward by as much as 50% in exchange for legalization of 700,000 of the 11,000 unauthorized immigrants currently in the U.S. That doesn't seem like a super even deal. The continued insistence on ending chain migration in the White House right now seems like a signal that they're less interested in getting to a deal on DACA than they are in treating their entire immigration agenda, which is a radical remaking of American immigration policy, as this obvious done deal that Democrats must ultimately fold on.
Dara Lind from Vox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a final thought before we leave you today, and some trivia, if you don't mind. Who was the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate? Because the U.S. Senate changes shape today with the swearing in of two new members. Alabama Democrat Doug Jones gets sworn in, shrinking that GOP majority to 51-49. And Minnesota Democrat Tina Smith replaces Al Franken. Tina Smith makes 22 women in the U.S. Senate. That's a record. That first elected woman senator, Hattie Caraway from Arkansas, 1932. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language, like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
And LegalZoom.com, providing public radio listeners with legal advice and guidance on business matters and estate plans through its network of independent attorneys. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.